You know Dr. Charles Howard as the Emeritus Professor of Religion at Campbell College in North Carolina. For more than 20 years, he was head of the Bible department there. And in these last few years, he's been blessing the hearts of many Christians across our nation as he has come to share in Bible and in evangelism conferences and preaching in the churches. We welcome you back, sir, to Texas and pray for you as you come now to preach to us. Dr. Howard.
Thank you, beloved brother. I've noticed three things about the early Christians. They were always telling what God had done for them. They were forevermore getting into trouble. And they were ridiculously happy. Well, I claim the third of these right now, and maybe a part of the other two. How good it is to be among Texas Baptists again. We Carolina Baptists love you. We've had a hard time forgiving you for taking George Truett away from us when he was a little boy, and for taking Forrest Feaser away from us when he was not much more than a little boy, and Marshall Craig, and I don't know how many other Carolina boys have come to bless you in Texas. But I never come to a meeting in Texas that I don't think of that little church in the edge of Virginia, which was a little while ago observing its sesquicentennial. Among other guests, the Episcopalian rector was present, to whom the Baptist pastor said, by way of recognizing and welcoming him, "Thank you, Brother Rector, for coming to be with us today to mark our 150th anniversary, even if your grandfathers did put our grandfathers in jail here in Virginia for preaching the gospel." Well, the rector took it in stride, laughed good-naturedly, but his time came directly. And he said, "I have to admit that my grandfathers did put your Baptist grandfathers in jail here in Virginia 150 years ago. But brother and sister Baptist, let's set the record straight. We didn't put them in jail for preaching the gospel. It was for blocking the traffic that we put these Baptists in jail." Well, I think of that always when I come into a convocation of Texas Baptists. It's a good thing to be with you again. Let me take a half minute to bring you greetings from Campbell College. We're getting along fairly well, thank you. We have 2,400 students and 2,600 automobiles. I think we're getting along fairly well. We counted the students. I'm just guessing at the number of cars, but there must be more cars than there are students. They tell it on one of our boys that he sent his daddy word to come in a hurry. There was an emergency. His father came post haste and said, "What is the trouble, son?" To hear his son reply, "It's this old car. I've got to have a new one this week." The father said, "Is that the emergency? Is it for this that you called me away from my office?" "Oh, yes," he said. "It's serious, Dad. I'm the only boy at Camel that hasn't a new car. Every boy at Camel College has a new car but me." His daddy said, "That's a fib and you know it. Look at that old car and that old car and..." "Oh," he said, "Daddy, they're the professor's cars. All the..." Glad you can laugh at that. It's not so funny to me. The last time Frank Lobach came to our college, I didn't agree with all his theology. I disagreed tearfully with a great deal of it. But I'm glad Dr. Frank came for one special reason. When he stood before the convocation, which was some less than 2,000 then, without saying a word of thanks for the splendid introduction that had been given, Frank Lobach shut his eyes and cried out, "Oh God, forgive me for ever looking on my world with dry eyes. Oh God, forgive me forever looking on my world with dry eyes. May I paraphrase the word of the great Frank Laubach and say it this way as I address myself to my part of the agenda here in this marvelous fellowship. Oh God, forgive me for ever looking upon any lost soul with dry eyes. The revelation says about that soul that they shall burn in torment forever and forever. They shall find no rest day nor night forever and forever. Jesus said about them, and shall cast them into outer darkness, there shall be wailing and gnashing of teeth. The writer of the to the Thessalonians, Paul the Apostle, said about them, who shall be punished with everlasting destruction from the presence of the Lord and from the glory of His power. You get out your Greek books, boys, and do a little exegesis on these verbal forms in this word which Paul wrote about eternal torment, and you'll find I'm within the pale of conservatively stated truth when I say that people who go to hell will feel like they're sinking, forever sinking, at never reaching ultimate bottom. People who go to hell will feel like they're being destroyed, continually and forever disintegrated, yet never annihilated. They'll have the feeling that they're going forever and forever and forever, progressively farther and farther away from God and from everything that's like God, yet never reaching ultimate distance. I didn't guess at that. I got that out of a very careful exegesis of the passage I've just quoted. Let me quote it again. Who shall be punished? Study that verb form. There's nothing about being cut off there. There's no aorist there. It's linear action forever and forever and forever. Who shall be forever punished with everlasting destruction. And the word means a state of being destroyed. Continued action forever and forever and forever. Oh, what eternal horrors hang beside that second death. I'm not going to spend any of the precious few minutes I have. I've promised to try to save 3 or 4 minutes to get us back a little more exactly on time. And I marvel that you stay as nearly on time as you do in this tremendous agenda with a discussion of the theology of the state of a lost person. You know that as well as I do and better than I do. And I leave that for the moment to talk about some of the more obvious and the more practical and to me the more poignant things about a lost soul. And foremost in them in my life and ministry for these 50 years of trying to win lost souls has been the one stubborn, unalterable fact that a lost man is on his way to eternal burning. I know that a lot of people don't believe in eternal hellfire anymore. I know that a lot of people say that hell isn't eternal fire, but that doesn't put the fire out, boys. It's there anyway, whether men believe it or not. And 5 seconds, 0.5 of 1 second, after a man or a woman dies without being born again, he'll know that hell is eternal burning. You change that and you cut one of the tap roots of evangelism. You change that and you cut one of the root nerves of foreign missions. I've seen boys and girls by the score in my 35 years at Camel College come on fire for a lost world. And then some allegedly smart professor gets that boy to wonder whether the lost people are really going to a burning hell or not. And 3/4 of them quit being priests and missionaries. I didn't say 1/4, Forrest. I said 3/4. About 1/4 of them wind up by being ministers and missionaries when they come enrolling in the school of the Bible, in the school of religion, in the school of religious education. education in the school of church music. These boys and girls who have their faith destroyed in an eternal hell and the lostness of people who have not known the blessed mystery and the mysterious blessedness of the new birth, they quit preaching. Well, thank God for that in a hell. But they quit preaching and they don't get to the mission fields when they lose their conviction about eternal hell. The more I study the Greek verbal forms about the experience people will have in eternal hell. Did you ever exegete that group of verbs? That group of verbs that describe the experiences people have in eternal hell. You'll cry out with dear old brother Frank, God forgive me for ever looking on my world with dry eyes. And when I say that people who are lost are on their way to hell, I do not grieve primarily because of the burning. I think the worst part about being lost is not going to a burning hell, but missing out on the big show out yonder when earth's last picture is painted, when the tubes are twisted and dried, when the oldest color is faded and the youngest critic has died. We shall rest and faith we shall need it. Lie down for an eon or two. Boy, he missed it there, didn't he? We're not going to lie down for an eon or two. We're going right on to be with the Lord. But that's the way the poet has it. Lie down for an eon or two till the master of all good workmen shall set us to work anew. And those that were good, he missed it there too. He ought to have said those that were saved. Those that were saved shall be happy. They shall sit in the golden chair. They shall splash it at 10-league canvas with brushes of comet's hair. And only the master shall praise us. And only the master shall blame. And no one shall work for money. And no one shall work for fame. But each for the joy of the working. And each in his separate star shall draw the thing as he sees it. For the God of things as they are. My heart goes out to lost men and lost women, wherever they are, in Carolina or Texas or the islands of the sea, in Latin America, in South Africa, in the British Isles, in behind the Iron Curtain and behind the other devilish and horrible curtains of our time, from which behind which the devil lifts his ugly mien. Wherever they are, the lost and the least and the lowest and the last of men, my heart goes out to them, because not so much they're going to burn in hell, but because they're going to miss out on the glories of God's eternal heaven. I was reading a little article the other day in the Coronet magazine. Mighty good literature is the Coronet magazine generally. And a man named Hubble over yonder at Mount Palomar with his 200-inch glass declared as he peered through it, I know now that God made at least 12 octillion suns when he made our solar system. That's 12, says Professor Hubble. That's 12 with 27 ciphers after it. That's more suns, says Professor Hubble, than there are grains of sand on all the seacoast on this planet. More suns. That's not counting the planets and the moons and the Sputniks and the Lunics and the... No, beatniks don't belong in that crowd, do you? Well, put them up there. Maybe that's where they belong. It doesn't count any of them, but just the suns. 12 octillion bodies like our sun yonder over the Texas sky this morning. 12 octillion bodies like that. And we're inclined to think that our sun is one of the smaller of them. 12 octillion. They can prove now, says Professor Hubble, that there are 12 octillion suns with their planets and moons hurtling around them. And when they make a 300-inch glass, don't you think they'll find 12 octillion more? I don't think it ever ends. I think the vastness of God's creation is like the immortality of our souls. I think it goes on and on and on. If it stops, what's on the other side of the stopping place? I just think it goes on and on and on and on and on. I want to tell you, friend, I'm going to do my best as long as I can draw breath and proclaim this wonderful truth. I think your word's going to be proclamation, isn't it, directly, Dr. Autry? I'm going to proclaim that truth from lip to ear and from heart to heart and man to man and person to person and from pulpit to pew as long as they let me preach. They threaten to stop me, you know, but they keep on letting me preach a little more. We old professors never die. We just lose our faculties, you know. I thank you for laughing, but shed a tear with me along, won't you, as I say, I don't want to miss out on God's great heaven when God sets us to work anew among 12 octillion solar systems, which they can see with the glass. They can see with man's eye 12 octillion. If they had time to look at all of them, it'd take a million lifetimes to look at them all, but they can prove it astronomically, mathematically, scientifically. They can prove now that there are 12 octillion suns out there, and that's just what they can see within the purview of a 200-inch glass at Mount Palomar. I was down by the sea with my grandchildren and their grandmama when I read that article, and I took out a little piece of paper, you know, the kind you write your sermon outline on Sunday morning just for Sunday school. I took out a little piece of paper and a little pencil and did a little figuring, Dr. Autry. Allow for the most fabulous estimate of population on our planet for 10,000 years past. Allow for exploding populations 10,000 years to come. Allow for quintillions of us being put on the moon and on Mars and other planets. Allow for all of that and divide that staggering figure into 12 octillion and the quotient will be more than 500. If every soul God ever created in the past 10,000 years on this planet, if everyone he's likely to create for the next 10,000 years, and I don't believe the parousia is that long off, do you? If it lasted 10,000 years more, every one of them, if they were all saved and in God's paradise, which is far from the truth, God's always moved in minorities since the Garden of Eden. But if they were all saved and in God's paradise, He could give every one of us 500 solar systems that they can already see out there if they had time to look at them. 500 solar systems to manage for him for a few billion millennia and have sextillions of suns left over. Oh, buddy, don't be in hell when the big show starts out yonder. Oh, the lostness of men. The lostness of men. But they're not only without participation in God's eternal heaven, they're without light here in the world. Oh, how dark is the heart of a man that does not know Jesus. I've lived in the academic community, and that phrase sickens me sometimes with some of its connotations, but I've lived in the academic community all my life since I was 6 years old. But the darkest hearts I've found, Brother Feaser, are the PhDs who do not know Jesus. Oh, the darkness in the heart. I asked a robin as he sprang from branch to branch as he sang, "What makes your breast so round and red?" Looking toward the sun, the robin said, "I saw the roses one by one unfold their petals to the sun. I asked, whence comes your color there so bright?" The roses answer, "Looking toward the light." I ask a thrush as his silvery note came like a song from an angel's throat, "What makes you sing in the twilight dim?" The thrush makes answer, "Looking up to him. I saw the violets wet and blue sparkling in the morning dew. I ask, whence comes your color there so shy?" The violets answered, "Looking toward the sky." And then I ask a Christian, heaven bent, 3/4 of a century for her master spent, "What makes you so happy every day?" "Looking unto Jesus, the only way." I love the business of going after lost men and lost women and lost boys and lost girls. Whether they're PhDs or whether they're freshly oriented in the freshman classes, or whether they're colored men working on the campus or farmers out in the neighborhood or people in the nearby city of Raleigh, which was blessed by Forrest Feaser's ministry, like few ministries I've ever known in my lifetime. I want to win them to Jesus because they have no peace in their hearts and they have no joy in their lives.
One of our richest boys came to the Lord on the second floor of one of our dormitories a little while ago. And about 3:30, he stepped across the line and entered into the marvelous peace that is the gift of God to those who trust in him. At breakfast time, 3 hours later, the little hunchback, Mabel Powell, whom some of you know and love, who said to John L. Hill in Kentucky, "Dr. John, ask Jesus to let me walk." And John Hill said to Mabel Powell, "Mabel, if God lets you walk, what will you do for him?" And Mabel said, "I'll take every step for him." Some of you Camel students sat with Mabel Powell and know that she's never taken a step for the devil, I guess, since that moment. Mabel met this brilliant and this wealthy boy on the cafeteria steps at 6:45. I left him about 4:15. She said, "Herbert, you look different this morning." He said, "Dr. Powell, I've got the best car on this campus, I reckon. My father in Raleigh is not a poor man. I give a party and he pays the bill. I buy a new suit when I like. And he raises no question. I've got his signed checkbook and I can write a check on Wachovia Bank for any reasonable amount. But Dr. Powell, I've had more fun. I've had more fun since 3:30 this morning than I've had all of my life put together. They're missing out on the real thrills and joys of life, and the only remedy is the new birth." The year 1809 has been called the year of battles. All eyes were on Napoleon. Where will he strike next? But God had a different idea in 1809. With God, the year 1809 was not the year of battles. It was the year of babies. Men turned to military might. God turned to the matrix of godly women. In the year 1809, Abraham Lincoln was born. In the year 1809, Oliver Wendell Holmes was born. In the year 1809, Elizabeth Barrett Browning, sweetheart of Robert and a great poet in her own right. Elizabeth was born in 1809. William E. Gladstone was born in 1809. Alfred Lord Tennyson was born in 1809. And on the continent, in a little village outside Warsaw, Frederick Chopin was born in 1809. And in old Hamburg, Felix Mendelssohn was born. God's still going at it that way. Not by might nor by battle, but by a birth. The first birth of earthly parentage, and then the second birth of heavenly parentage. God grant you will spend your days till traveling time is done, bringing lost people to this wonderful Savior. Amen.